Down to Business. Sponsored by Flowgas. Electricity from Flowgas. Powering Irish enterprise. Talk to us today, wherever you are. This is News Talk.
Now you're most welcome back. The second hour Down to Business. Bobby here, keeping you company all the way till 12 o'clock this morning. This is the show that talks to the most interesting people in Irish business. You can text us here at the station, 53106. It'll only cost you 30 cents. Low call me, 1-890-453-106. Email me at downtobusiness@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter, at Bobby Kerr, usual hashtag, Bobby Means Biz. Loads to come in this next hour. Shortly, I'm going to be speaking to three economists about making a living from booms and busts. In our executive chair, we speak to Declan Ronayn of Woody's about good weather and good business, and the book I could have written myself, which is What I Know About Running Coffee Shops. Colin Harmon will be in to talk about that a bit later on. So, just a quick shout out for the great lighthouses of Ireland. Lighthouses are wonderful places, and five lighthouses this weekend have an open house: Rathlin, Fannad, Loophead, Valentia, and Hook. There's loads of activities going on, from barbecues, cooking demos, music, the whole work. So go and see your local lighthouse. It's well worth doing. More information on greatlighthouses.com for more details. So good luck to them. Now, this week's industry review is all about the business of economists. And joining me in studio is one, Moore MacDool, Sean Barrett, and Susan Hayes Cullerton. All three of you are very welcome to the programme. Moore, I might start with you. Economists who make a living do, those who can't teach. Is it any coincidence that three of your teachers and speakers here in the studio with us this morning?
I think I might have said that on an advisory note to your researcher and said that was unfair, unfair.
Don't tell that to Bobby, whatever you do. So no. Tell me more, yeah. Tell me about, it's probably, you know, like when looking at it seriously for a second, it's probably no coincidence that if you're teaching, if you're writing research, if you're, you know, narrating on things, that you become noticed as somebody who is, I suppose, has a certain expertise on fiscal or economic matters.
You're presumed to have some expertise.
There you go.
Because you teach economics and because you do all this research. But often the things which are presumed to have expertise on may not be, in fact, the things in which you have any expertise. Because increasingly over my academic lifetime, economists have become more and more compartmentalized in their research, piling pebbles on the mountain of knowledge without working out whether the mountain's a volcano or not. So the degree to which, if you like, generalist economists are popular in academia is very low. You don't get promoted by going on News Talk.
Why are you here, Sal?
I'm retired. From academia, I should say. Not from blathering on radio. But you see, go back to those who can do and those who can't research. In another sense, that's correct. In the universities, if you want to get on, you must do research. And those who can't do research then rely on their teaching prowess to get promoted.
Okay.
But in the weighting which is given to teaching is much lower than the weighting which is given to research. There are various reasons for this, but the simplest is that you can quantify to some extent the amount of research, because it's very simple. How many peer-reviewed papers have you produced in the last year?
So it's a tangible measurement.
So you have there's a huge return to doing research, but the research increasingly is in a narrower and narrower field. And then you get an invitation, some of them do, to go on and talk about budgetary policy. And frequently the people you might ask to come in aren't really interested in budgetary policy. In fact, often they're not interested in policy at all.
Okay.
Because they're pure, they're like physicists or meteorologists.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's bring in Sean Barrett. Sean, lovely to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Moore mentioned it there about the specialization. Transport has always been your thing, in terms of, from writing about trucks crossing the border after the wall to things that are goings on out at Aer Lingus or in Aer Lingus or aviation generally. Have you found yourself sort of pigeonholed in a particular area?
Well, there's a wider public service element. I mean, it was interesting, and Moore was part of the group that worked in some of these things, that why did we in Europe ban new airlines for 50 years plus? And so, why was it £208 to go to London and £550 to Brussels? It must be possible by opening up the market. And Adam Smith would tell you that. And then William Baumol, president of the American Economics Association, subsequently, that barriers to entry, such as regulators, are long inclined to impose, should start out with a strong presumption against their adoption. But we do it all the time. You get regulatory capture. So I found that students were very receptive to this, and that's been my total career, and I've loved every minute of it.
One of your students was one Michael O'Leary, is that right?
Indeed. Yeah. And Peter Bellew, who now does some of Michael's work, at least. So then you come on programs like this and people say, yeah, I think he's right. Maybe we should have more people in the aviation business in Europe rather than a cartel of state airlines. Ryanair this year will be the biggest airline in Europe, 131 million passengers. The Aer Lingus we were defending in the 1980s had 2.3 million passengers. So it's grown out of all. I remember cases, a man thought he could run a bus from Dublin to Galway much cheaper than the monopolist. And there's something like 65 buses a day. It was one when it was a monopoly. So economics would have told that to us. Our students have said, yes, that sounds right. We come on programs like this, people listen in from Leinster House. So I think economics, and John Kelzingham, the founder of the Statistical Society, is very keen on this, that it serves the wider society, not just the collection, as Ingram said, of dilettante statistics. I've always felt economics serves society. If in our ideas and in our talks, in our conferences, people like Moore, myself, Colin McCarthy and others, get ideas which make society a better place, let's give it a try, get in there to bat for those ideas. And there's been a fairly receptive public for that. And Ryanair is one of the examples, new competing bus services on the intercity route.
You won't get promoted for it in the university.
But you can do these things to serve the country and to serve the wider society. And to know you're right when there are more buses now passing by the end of my road going to Galway than when it was a monopoly.
Let me introduce our third guest, Susan Hayes Cullerton, a finance expert and also a degree of financial maths and economics from NUIG. You're very welcome to the programme, Susan. You promote yourself as a positive economist. Is that a dangerous territory on the basis that economists should be telling us blandly what the facts are rather than being positive about a particular situation?
Well, Bobby, I have more in common with you probably this morning than I do with our two fellow guests, namely that I'm in business and therefore...
Well, that's why you're here, to help me challenge
these
two.
Right, yeah, we'll stick together on that. Being the positive economist is about focusing on the opportunity within whatever it might be. So, for example, earlier on this week at the All Ireland Dialogue, I was speaking about our Brexit strategy, where you're looking at the trends presented by the economy, but actually then looking for, well, what can we do about it? So whether it is looking at the SME scorecard from Enterprise Ireland, or whether it is expanding into Asian markets, or whether it is finding supports around the world with a view to expanding our business strategy, that's what I'm about.
Yeah.
So it is really not just about looking at trends and figuring out variables and as you say, blandly explaining the facts, but leaving people with something that they can do thereafter.
Okay, so you like to say that you add maybe more than just a view. You present the facts as they pertain, and then you say this is what you should do with these facts.
Yes, what I want to leave people with is an action plan.
Okay.
And it's about looking at a range of different things. So it may not just be geography, it could be whether it is about demographics or a range of other different things.
You also said that if you put every economist end to end around the world, you still wouldn't come up with a conclusion.
This is like Moore's one now, earlier on, where I said this was a misconception and the one I was going to challenge. You see, he's a devil for this, isn't he?
I didn't say that.
No, you didn't say it, Moore, but I'm putting it to you.
I'm taking those words out of my mouth.
Well, I will share a view on that, and that many of us are often, the minute we say, well, on the other hand, we're immediately, that joke is said about us. But if we didn't come up with conclusions, Bobby, there wouldn't be an industry for us. So I would say it's a complete misconception. We have to come up, in fact, that's the one thing we do is conclude all the time.
Well, if we talk about something more like Brexit, you would suggest that most economists of any degree of sanity probably concur on generally what that Brexit isn't going to be good for us.
Oh yeah, I was going
would
to. I was going
would
to.
Would that
ask,
be fair enough to
I
say?
Was taking to the point, you know, they disagree and put them. What you say, one after the other, you don't never get a conclusion. I don't know anybody in Ireland in the economics profession who would say that Brexit's going to be a good thing for Ireland. They agree totally on that. Brexit may present opportunities, which we could have taken anyway, but there will be a cost associated with Brexit. We could disagree as to the level of that cost because you make certain assumptions and so on. But, I mean, if you put it another way, the way economists would, I don't know any economist who doesn't believe that demand curves slope down.
Right.
In other words, that prices and the quantity people want to consume are related negatively. Now, so they do agree on things.
They may not
agree. Let's take a case appointment. They may not agree on the proposition that to deal with people drinking too much, you should introduce minimum pricing. Personally, I think that's daft. But there are people I know who are economists who say, no, it's not daft. And here are my reasons for saying it's not daft. So in other words, they see me as making a set of assumptions and they're operating from different assumptions.
That brings me on to another point. If you take, and it's a good point you make, if you take somebody like an economist that's working for a bank and then on the other side of the table is an economist working for SIPTU, just by way of example, they come from different places, they represent probably different values in terms of their organisations. Are they ever going to agree on anything? No.
I'm going to tread very delicately here. I know several economists who work for banks. And as long as we're talking quietly in Doheny or Nesbitt's, I listen to them. But when they go public, by and large, you must remember they're being paid by a bank.
That's what I mean. So
and the same applies to people who are paid by Liberty Hall or other allied.
So my question
agencies.
Is, are you compromised by that if you're one of those economists?
That's a hard one to say.
This is why I'm
That's
completely independent. This is exactly why I'm completely independent. And don't frequent Donny and Nesbitt's, I have to say. This is precisely the reason.
It's not the pub we're talking about, though. It's changed. Onions has changed. They're very bad about letting women in when I started.
Well, now, more if... Anyway, we won't go there because that would lead us off to a totally different discussion.
Sean Barrett, what about your views on that? Compromised in terms of the sector you represent?
No, because that's the nature of the university.
Absolutely.
It's for the free expression of ideas. And it's probably why most economists who work in university stay there. I would hate to be constrained by what the man upstairs or the boss of the organisation thinks. And you know, this came out in the banking matter. The bank economists, as Moore said, were pretty appalling witnesses at the Oireachtas bank inquiry. And the star of the show was Morgan Kelly, Moore's colleague, who predicted it with deadly accuracy and is a hero in my mind.
And was rewarded by being described as Dr. Doom.
Only by some, Moore.
Oh, by a lot of people.
Well,
a lot of people are behind its back.
Yeah.
It was denigrated.
Yeah. What about the perception, Sean, about economists being capitalists because they support markets? Is that unfair to say?
No, because capitalists are pretty successful at forming cartels, restrictive practices, and there's a whole branch of economics taking on, particularly in the United States, if it might be ironic, the Sherman Act, Clayton Act, in combating these fellows. Alfred Kahn, one of my heroes in economics, took on the American aviation sector, which was all privately owned, and stopped them being a cartel. They didn't like him one bit for it, but the consumers did, and Ted Kennedy was one of his supporters. And I think that, you know, the parallel in that would be Desimale's participation in the consumer cause in Ireland. But capture is a problem, and economists won't be liked. For instance, there's a huge public capital programme in the new National Development Plan. I think it's wrong. I agree with Moore about the minimum pricing of drink. I think that's wrong because the publican gets to keep the extra money. So you find yourself being unpopular with the sectors which you criticise. So what? We serve the wider society, and particularly it's brilliant 18 to 22 year olds who are our clients every day.
Okay. Susan, I had an email in from a regular listener called Shane. He said to me, yeah, I see you have economists on the show this morning. I'm going to read out a small bit of what he said, but I would ask you to challenge your guest to explain properly the most misunderstood and yet I would argue one of the more fundamental parts of the economy, the creation of money. Simply put the question to them, how is money created and by whom?
Well,
over to you, Susan.
I'm happy to take that one on. Actually, the question that Shane asks, and it's great to hear from him this morning, is actually, it's one of the, I co-wrote the economics textbook for Leaving Cert, and that was a full and probably the biggest chapter there is in monetary and macroeconomics. And it actually all begins with a central bank. But the problem is that it's often created as debt in the first place, which is that a central bank creates it and then lends it to a government.
So it doesn't exist if it's debt?
Well, it does exist. Oh no, ask the person who has to pay it back, Bobby, they'll tell you. But no, it exists all right. But the thing is that it's not actually about pounds, shillings and pence.
So you can't have it in your hand.
It's the wider M3 money supply, which means that when it's actually lent in, when it's deposited into a bank and then lent out, it can then be created more and more and more. And that's the whole root of Keynesian economics. So the point is that it starts off at a central bank, is lent to a government, and then ultimately it's up to the consumer to make it real.
Thanks for making that simple. I'm way out of my depth here.
I would try to answer that briefly by saying, asking Shane, what is it that you use as money? What is money? Mm-hmm. Of course it's cash in your pocket or a few notes in your wallet.
Yeah, but it could be a QR code today, more.
Of course, that is money because it's acceptable in exchange. But most of us have bank accounts. Most of us have savings accounts. And they would say, I've got money in the bank. Actually, Susan's right, the bank owes them money. And what they do when they write a check or they use their credit card is they call in the bank's loan and they hand it over to somebody else.
Right.
So it's absolute money in a modern economy isn't gold, it's not metal, only in its very small sense is it the cash in your pocket. It is the liabilities of financial institutions.
Okay.
And it includes the liabilities of the government.
Last word to Sean Barrett. The creation of money, Sean, if you could be brief. If an economist can be brief, can you be brief?
Good to say, I refer to Mr. Mario Draghi. He does more of this. I think he's printed
on the money
in the recent past.
QE.
But one of the points on this, what's the difference between dry cleaners, bicycle shops and banks? Unfortunately, we rescue banks when they go broke. Dry cleaners and bicycle shops don't impose that burden. So if I support Minister Donohue in not giving bonuses to bankers, we're still 64 billion short. When they pay us back, we might consider, and I'm glad the ECB supported Minister Donohue on that.
Okay. I think I personally agree with you on that, but I'm not sure everybody does. But listen, it's been a wonderful chat. I knew it would be good and I knew I wouldn't get a word in. Thank my guests, Moore MacDool, Sean Barrett and Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Thank you all very much for joining
us. Bobby.
In a subject we haven't covered before on Down to Business, and I knew it would be fascinating as it was. Up next, it's all about coffee. Stay tuned.
Down to Business. On